Welcome, welcome to today's episode of the Law of Self-Defense Show. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. And as the title of today's show suggests, this is a part two of our reading of the Law Review article, The Peculiar Story of U.S. v. Miller. Rather than restate U.S. v. Miller all over again, there is an introduction to what we'll be talking about today in part one of this two-part show. So I have put a link in the description of today's show to part one. I urge you to read that first. And then in that description, there's a link back here. So if you haven't listened or watched part one of The Peculiar Story of U.S. v. Miller, I urge you to do that right now. And now that you have, let's continue with part two of the Law Review article by none other than Brian L. Fry, attorney Brian Fry. He wrote this Law Review article in 2008, just before D.C. versus Heller, the first of the series of modern U.S. Supreme Court decisions on the Second Amendment. And he's writing about the case of United States v. Miller, a U.S. Supreme Court decision from 1939, which was the first U.S. Supreme Court decision that dealt with defining the legal boundaries of the Second Amendment. The defendant here, Jack Miller, was a small-time bank robber who had snitched on his bank robbing gang, was ultimately released from prison, and then got back into a life of crime, as we'll see right here. Today's show is sponsored by the Law of Self-Defense, specifically our advanced live online class taking place on April 20th, 2024. This is our full-day course on use of force law that makes you hard to convict if you're ever compelled to use force in defense of yourself, your family, or your property. We cover everything you need to know, why and how the legal system prosecutes self-defense, the five elements of self-defense, the fundamental building blocks of any claim of self-defense. We cover defense of others and defense of property, consciousness of guilt, self-defense immunity. We spend almost an hour talking about interacting with the police in the aftermath of a use of force event, how to craft your own customized, legally sound self-defense strategy, and much, much more. Now, we only teach this class twice a year at most. So if you missed this April course, it'll be at least 6 months before you have the opportunity to take this course again and make yourself hard to convict. Do you know when you're going to be attacked? It's not up to you. The bad guy chooses the time, place, and manner of attack. You need to be ready for both the physical fight and the legal fight before that happens. And register now, and you can get up to 50% off for this April 20th Law of Self-Defense live online advanced course. Don't hesitate. Scan that QR code now, or simply visit lawofselfdefense.com/advanced. We're about halfway through the Law Review article. Here we go. We're at section 2F, the postscript of Jack Miller. Postscript. So this is now after the U.S. v. Miller court decision, and Miller is a free man. In the meantime, Miller resurfaced. On April 3rd, 1939, Jack Miller, Robert Drake, Major Taylor, and an unidentified accomplice robbed the Route 66 Club, a Miami, Oklahoma dive. Armed with shotguns, they stole about $80, superficially wounding two bystanders in the process. Apparently, it was an inside job. Earl Woodenfoot Clanton, the uncle of notorious bank robbers Herman and Ed Newt Clanton, owned the bar. Taylor was a former associate of New Clanton's and a peripheral member of the O'Malley gang. At about 9 a.m. on April 3rd, two or three men in a car picked up Miller at his home in Ketchup, Oklahoma. The next day around noon, a farmhand named Fisher discovered Miller's bullet-ridden corpse on the bank of the nearly dry Little Spencer Creek, 9 miles southwest of Chelsea, Oklahoma. Miller was shot four times with a .38, twice in the chest, once under the left arm, and once through the left arm. The .45 automatic next to him had been fired three times. On April 6th, someone found Miller's torched 1934 sedan off a dirt road in the Verdigris River bottoms, about 4 miles southwest of Nowata. It was stripped and still smoldering. A farmer said he saw it burning shortly before noon on April 3rd. Taylor was a suspect in the investigation. On October 8, 1939, Sheriff Ellis Summers arrested him in Kermit, Texas, after he got in a fight with an oil field worker over a dice game. Ultimately, what happened on April 4th is unclear. Maybe Miller and Taylor disputed the proceeds of the robbery. Maybe Taylor shot Miller for snitching on the O'Malleys. In any case, Oklahoma charged Taylor with murder, but eventually dropped the charges for lack of evidence. Still, he pleaded guilty to armed robbery and got 10 years in McAlester. On January 8, 1940, Layton pleaded guilty to the reinstated NFA charge. This was the co-defendant, so it was Jack Miller and Layton were both charged in the U.S. v. Miller arrangement for having the short-barreled shotgun. On January 8, 1940, Layton pleaded guilty to the reinstated NFA charge, and federal trial judge Ragon, who had set up this test case, he was a gun controller, sentenced him to 5 years probation. Trial court Ragon expected an appointment to the Eighth Circuit, in other words, a promotion from trial court, federal trial court, to federal appeals court, but died suddenly of a heart attack on September 15, 1940. Layton's probation ended on January 29, 1945. He died in 1967. Both Jack Miller of U.S. v. Miller and Layton were buried at Woodlawn Cemetery in Claremore, Oklahoma, where they'd grown up, basically. Section 3 of this law review article interpreting United States v. Miller. Both individual and collective rights theorists claim Miller adopted their position. But few Second Amendment scholars spend much time analyzing Miller because few take it seriously. Most assume that Justice McReynolds, who authored the U.S. v. Miller decision, was either uninterested in or incapable of drafting a competent opinion and dismiss Miller as hopelessly opaque. However, this consensus reflects the identity of the author as much as the quality of his opinion. Many justices were poor draftsmen, but none are as universally despised as McReynolds. The last of the quote-unquote four horsemen, he's remembered only as a cranky bigot, notorious for shunning Justice Brandeis and referring to blacks as quote-unquote darkies. Even his own lone biographer characterized him as, quote, an easy man to dislike, on occasion intolerant, cantankerous, and rude, close quote. And yet Justice McReynolds' peers were far more charitable. Fellow Justice Holmes considered him acute. Justice Taft described him as a man of real ability and great sharpness of intellect. Justice Frankfurter despised him, but respected his abilities. Even Brandeis conceded that McReynolds is capable of effective writing. The problem was, quote, his studied avoidance of obiter, even when there may have been an alluring temptation to catch the public eye by some spectacular utterance, close quote. Or rather his, quote, curious notion that opinions were essentially superfluities anyway, and that the less said, the better, close quote. True to form, the decision of Miller is quite terse. The 9-page opinion consists primarily of lengthy quotations and string cites anchored by a few paragraphs of crabbed analysis. Still, it was not an afterthought. Chief Justice Hughes usually assigned opinions at the Saturday conference after argument. So what they're talking about here is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. When the court hears an oral argument, it'll then assign to one of the, either to himself or to one of the other justices, the duty to write the opinion. The court's response could assign it to any of the justices. The article continues. But Chief Justice Hughes fell ill in mid-March 1939 and did not return to the bench for several weeks after Miller was argued and assigned. As the most senior associate justice, McReynolds assigned cases in Chief Justice Hughes' absence while he was out sick. Apparently, Justice McReynolds assigned Miller to himself, presumably because he considered it important. The National Firearms Act found an unlikely champion in McReynolds, who had been a foe of federal regulation. While McReynolds was a Democrat, he was no New Dealer. On the contrary, he was a gold Democrat who detested Roosevelt and the New Deal alike. And he hated Attorney General Cummings, too. As the architect of Roosevelt's court packing plan, Roosevelt's plan to pack the Supreme Court, Attorney General Cummings added insult to injury by citing a superficially similar proposal McReynolds himself advanced in 1913 about court packing. Just as McReynolds knew gun control was part of the New Deal program, he knew Miller and Layton were gangsters, and he knew that Miller was a Second Amendment test case. But he barely addressed the Second Amendment in his U.S. v. Miller decision. Instead, he discussed the nature of the militia and the history of its governance, and he concluded the Second Amendment does not protect short-barreled shotguns because they aren't military weapons. Ironically enough, modern gun controllers argue that the Second Amendment doesn't protect AR-15s because they are military weapons. Whatever argument is convenient at the moment. Oddly, in his U.S. v. Miller decision, Justice Reynolds began by holding that the National Firearms Act does not violate the 10th Amendment by infringing state police power. Quote, considering Sandinski v. United States and what was ruled in sundry causes arising under the Harrison Narcotic Act, the objection that the act usurps police power reserved to the states is plainly untenable, close quote. And now the author of the Law Review article is going to touch upon a point I should perhaps explain. So the Supreme Court is only supposed to be deciding cases based on arguments that were made to it. And one of the theoretical arguments against the NFA is that it violates the 10th Amendment. But in fact, that argument was never made to the U.S. Supreme Court. So Justice McReynolds, in writing his response to the arguments in this case, should not even be writing about the 10th Amendment because that argument was never made to the Supreme Court in the first place. But he's doing it anyway. Let's see. So oddly, McReynolds began by holding that the National Firearms Act does not violate the 10th Amendment by infringing state police power. But federal trial judge Regan, the gun controller who orchestrated this as a test case, did not reach Miller's 10th Amendment claim, and the government did not brief on it. So it was not properly before the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course, Sandinski did indeed foreclose most 10th Amendment objections to the NFA, but Justice McReynolds was notoriously punctilious about jurisdiction. It is surprising he addressed the 10th Amendment issue at all. In fact, Justice Reynolds alone thought the NFA does not violate the 10th Amendment. Today, Congress can regulate virtually anything under the Commerce Clause. But when Congress drafted the NFA in 1934, the U.S. Supreme Court prohibited federal regulation of interstate commerce under the Commerce Clause. Because Congress could not regulate directly under the Commerce Clause in 1934, it regulated indirectly under the Tax Clause. For example, the Harrison Narcotics Act effectively regulated narcotics by taxing them and enforcing the tax. The Supreme Court held such regulatory taxation did not infringe state police power so long as it produced some revenue. Everybody remember how Chief Justice Roberts said Obamacare was okay because it was a tax, even though the government never denied, explicitly said it was not a tax? In any case, the majority of the Supreme Court held such regulatory taxation did not infringe state police power so long as it produced some tax revenue. The minority of the U.S. Supreme Court and their predecessors disagreed. They conceded, and this would include Justice McReynolds, they conceded Congress can both tax narcotics and punish tax evasion, but argued the Harrison Narcotics Act is, quote, beyond the constitutional power of Congress to enact because to such extent the statute was a mere attempt by Congress to exert a power not delegated, that is, the reserved police power of the states, close quote. In other words, they thought regulatory taxes violated the 10th Amendment. So prior precedent and continuing Justice McReynolds argued that, listen, just because you call it a tax, you can't backdoor in unconstitutional federal regulation by simply saying, well, it raised a dollar of taxes, so that makes it constitutional. Continuing now with the Law Review article. For years, Justice McReynolds continued to object to regulatory taxes on 10th Amendment and due process grounds, gradually getting lonelier and lonelier. In other words, the other justices on his side retired and got replaced with judges who bought the Chief Justice John Roberts tax theory. Eventually, even Justice McReynolds threw in the towel. In 1937, Max Zinczynski, a notorious East St. Louis fence, challenged the NFA under the 10th Amendment. Justice McReynolds joined the unanimous opinion upholding the law. And in Miller, U.S. v. Miller, he relied on a variety of other U.S. Supreme Court decisions, the very cases in which he resisted the Harrison Narcotics Act. In any case, Justice McReynolds began U.S. v. Miller by emphasizing the National Firearms Act satisfies the 10th Amendment only because it is at least nominally a tax rather than a regulation. As the government pointed out, quote, even as to this class of firearms, there is not a word in the National Firearms Act which expressly prohibits the obtaining, ownership, possession, or transportation thereof by anyone if compliance is had with the provisions relating to registration, the payment of taxes, and the possession of stamp affixed orders, close quote. So, whatever it holds, U.S. v. Miller does not hold that Congress can regulate firearms directly. The rejection of Miller's 10th Amendment claim highlights the implausibility of his Second Amendment claim. Miller could not just argue that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to possess and use NFA firearms, meaning short-barreled shotguns, short-barreled rifles, machine guns, suppressors. He had to claim the Second Amendment prohibits taxation of NFA firearms. Unsurprisingly, Justice McReynolds found this claim unconvincing. Whether or not the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to keep and bear arms, it hardly prohibits Congress from taxing particular weapons. Justice McReynolds assumed the Second Amendment guarantees the right to keep and bear arms in order to ensure an effective militia exists. Quote, with obvious purpose to assure the continuation and render possible the effectiveness of such forces, the declaration and guarantee of the Second Amendment were made. It must be interpreted and applied with that end in view, close quote. In other words, the militia clause in the U.S. Constitution empowers Congress to regulate the militia, and the Second Amendment ensures the militia is armed. Accordingly, Justice McReynolds devoted most of U.S. v. Miller to analyzing the composition of the militia and the duties of militia service. After consulting the debates in the convention, the Constitutional Convention, the history and legislation of colonies and states, and the writings of approved commentators, he concluded the militia consists of, quote, all males physically capable of acting in concert for the common defense, close quote. Essentially, everyone subject to conscription. And further, that ordinarily when called for service, these men were expected to appear bearing arms supplied by themselves and of the kind in common use at the time. Like the Cooley treatise on which he relied, Justice McReynolds assumed the militia, quote, cannot exist unless the people are trained to bearing arms, close quote. A militiaman may own a firearm because he must know how to use one. In other words, Justice McReynolds assumed the Second Amendment guarantee ensures those subject to conscription may possess weapons suitable for militia service. And he held it does not protect NFA firearms as a matter of law because they, NFA firearms, aren't suitable for militia service. Really? Machine guns aren't suitable for militia service? In the absence of any, quoting now from Justice McReynolds, quote, in the absence of any evidence tending to show that possession or use of a shotgun having a barrel of less than 18 inches in length at this time has some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia, we cannot say that the Second Amendment guarantees the right to keep and bear such an instrument. Certainly, it is not within judicial notice that this weapon is any part of the ordinary military equipment or that its use could contribute to the common defense, close quote. By the way, folks, why was there an absence of evidence on the issue of whether or not an 18-inch barrel shotgun had military utility? Because remember, Jack Miller didn't show up in court, and there was no lawyer before the U.S. Supreme Court arguing his position. The only arguments made to the U.S. Supreme Court were the arguments of the government. That's it. The government that wanted the National Firearms Act to be found constitutional. And we all know if you only hear one side of an argument, it always sounds compelling, doesn't it? Continuing now with the Law Review article. A short-barreled shotgun is a weapon, but it is not a militia weapon, and the Second Amendment only protects militia weapons. Again, today, modern gun control fascists are arguing that the guns that should not get Second Amendment protection are precisely the ones that would be militia weapons. The opposite position argued here. Continuing now with the Law Review article. Essentially, Justice McReynolds adopted the government's fallback argument. The Second Amendment does not protect weapons used by criminals. Justice McReynolds often worked directly from the briefs, and the only briefs here were from the government. Briefs being arguments, written arguments to the court. Justice McReynolds often worked directly from the briefs, incorporating elements from them into his opinions. In support of his holding in U.S. v. Miller, he cited only Ament v. State, a Tennessee case holding the right to keep and bear arms doesn't guarantee the right to carry a concealed Bowie knife. The government cited Ament for the proposition that the term arms, as used in constitutional provisions, refers only to those weapons which are ordinarily used for military or public defense purposes and does not relate to those weapons which are commonly used by criminals. Justice McReynolds agreed, concluding that the Second Amendment only protects weapons reasonably related to militia service, not including short-barreled shotguns. But he did not specify which weapons the Second Amendment does protect or how it protects them. McReynolds also adopted the government's argument that the Second Amendment did not create a right, but guaranteed a pre-constitutional common law right. Quote, "The Second Amendment does not confer upon the people the right to keep and bear arms. It is one of the provisions of the Constitution which, recognizing the prior existence of a certain right, declares that it shall not be infringed by Congress." Close quote. Notably, Justice McReynolds' analysis of the militia relied exclusively on pre-ratification sources, sources from before the ratification of the Constitution. And he closed by linking the Second Amendment guarantee to state constitutional guarantees. Quote, "Most, if not all of the states, have adopted provisions touching the right to keep and bear arms. Differences in the language employed in these have naturally led to somewhat variant conclusions concerning the scope of the right guaranteed, but none of them seem to afford any material support for the challenged ruling of the court below." Close quote. That would be the federal trial court of Judge Ragon, who created this as a test case to end up with precedent supporting that the National Firearms does not infringe the Second Amendment. It was all orchestrated. Apparently, Justice McReynolds assumed the scope of the Second Amendment guarantee depends upon the relevant state constitution, or at the very least, the guarantees incorporated into the state constitutions illuminate the scope of the right guaranteed by the Second Amendment. Of course, Justice McReynolds generally assumed the Constitution simply protects common law rights. And he, as he memorably put it in Meyer v. Nebraska, the Constitution guarantees, quote, "not merely freedom from bodily restraint, but also the right of the individual to contract, to engage in any of the common occupations of life, to acquire useful knowledge, to marry, establish a home and bring up children, to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience, and generally to enjoy those privileges long recognized at common law as essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men." Close quote. And the Constitution protects those common law rights against federal and state governments alike. Quote, "As often heretofore pointed out, rights guaranteed by the Constitution may not be abridged by legislation which has no reasonable relationship to some purpose within the competency of the state." Close quote. And, quote, "liberty may not be interfered with under the guise of protecting the public interest by legislative action which is arbitrary or without reasonable relation to some purpose within the competency of the state to effect." Close quote. Basically, Justice McReynolds believed in a reasonable constitution, and a reasonable constitution permits reasonable regulation. So the Second Amendment protects a weapon only if its possession and use, quote, has some reasonable relationship to the preservation or efficiency of a well-regulated militia. In other words, Miller held the common law right to keep and bear arms only protects weapons related to militia service, not including NFA firearms. Congress can tax NFA firearms because the Second Amendment doesn't protect them. But Miller did not explain what makes a weapon related to militia service, nor did it explicitly adopt an individual or collective right theory of the Second Amendment. It did not have to. The NFA was reasonable on either theory, as it affected only unprotected by the Second Amendment weapons. Some individual right theorists argue Miller held the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to keep and bear any weapon with a military use. They claim the court upheld the NFA only because Miller failed to present any evidence of the many military uses of short-barreled shotguns, including trench and jungle warfare. But machine guns obviously had military uses. Surely Miller did not invalidate the NFA tax on machine guns sub silentio, without saying so explicitly. As the First Circuit recognized 3 years later in Cases v. United States, quote, the rule of the Miller case would seem to be already outdated because of the well-known fact that in the so-called commando units, some sort of military use seems to have been found for almost any modern lethal weapon, including short-barreled shotguns, close quote. Indeed, the government implicitly conceded that NFA firearms have military uses. Quote, it may be assumed that Congress, in inserting these provisions in the National Firearms Act, intended through the exercise of its taxing power and its power to regulate interstate and foreign commerce to discourage, except for military and law enforcement purposes, the traffic in and utilization of the weapons to which the act refers, close quote. It nevertheless argued the Second Amendment does not protect NFA firearms because they, quote, form the arsenal of the gangster and desperado, close quote. The Miller court agreed, concluding, quote, it is not within judicial notice that this weapon is any part of the ordinary military equipment or that its use could contribute to the common defense, close quote. Again, there was no judicial notice because there was no evidence presented to support that position because the defendants and their lawyer never showed up to court to argue to the U.S. Supreme Court. Only the federal government showed up with lawyers to argue to the U.S. Supreme Court, the federal government that wanted the NFA to found to be not infringing the Second Amendment. Continuing now with the law review opinion. While short-barreled shotguns, machine guns, and silencers may have military uses, they aren't appropriate for militia service. Nor will civilian use help preserve the peace. Relying on AMET, the Miller court assumed the Second Amendment only protects the right to possess arms, quote, usually employed in civilized warfare, close quote, not, quote, those weapons which are usually employed in private broils and which are efficient only in the hands of the robber and the assassin, close quote. Of course, short-barreled shotguns do have legitimate civilian uses, primarily protection on hunting small game. Pre the National Firearms Act, firearms manufacturers had long produced short-barreled shotguns or their functional equivalent. However, Miller's gun was homemade, as Stevens, the manufacturer of the gun, never produced a shotgun with a barrel shorter than 18 inches. And in any case, Miller assumed taxation, regulation, or even prohibition of NFA firearms is reasonable whether or not they have legitimate civilian uses, as is taxation, regulation, and prohibition of many other varieties of firearm. Miller assumed the Second Amendment only guarantees the right to possess and use a firearm suitable for militia service, not any particular firearm. Some collective right theorists argue Miller held the Second Amendment only protects a collective right to form a militia or even a state's right to maintain a militia. Many courts have agreed. But this reading is plainly untenable because the Miller court assumed Miller and Layton had standing to assert an individual right of some kind. Arguably, an individual could assert a collective right to participate in militia service, but Miller did not challenge the NFA as a limitation on his right to participate in militia service. He challenged his indictment for transporting an untaxed NFA firearm in interstate commerce. And the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, evaluated Miller's right to possess and use a particular firearm, not his right to join the militia. Everyone knew Miller and Layton were criminals and unlikely militiamen. They certainly were not pinched during a muster. But the Supreme Court did not ask whether Miller and Layton intended to participate in militia service. It only asked whether the Second Amendment protects NFA firearms. Furthermore, Justice McReynolds adopted a colloquial reading of the Second Amendment guarantee. Second Amendment scholars dispute the original meaning of the terms keep and bear. This has long since now been decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in Heller, McDonald, Caetano, and Bruin. But back in 2008, even Heller hadn't happened yet at the time this was published. Heller was handed down in later in 2008. Individual right theorists claim keep meant private ownership. Collective right theorists claim both terms mean military use. But Justice McReynolds assumed keep means possess and bear means use. And to possess and use a weapon implies private ownership. Basically, Justice McReynolds adopted a traditional common sense interpretation of the Second Amendment, assuming it guarantees an individual right to possess and use firearms subject to reasonable regulation of time, place, and manner. Alternatively, a cynic could dismiss Miller, U.S. v. Miller, as simply holding the Constitution doesn't protect criminals. When the Supreme Court upheld the NFA in Sunzinski, quote, government attorneys hailed the decision as a material aid in the war against gangsters and gunmen, close quote. And as a former attorney general, Justice McReynolds surely appreciated the convenience of laws like the NFA. After all, everyone knew Miller and Layton were gangsters, and a right exercised in morality cannot sustain a right to be exercised in immorality. But Justice McReynolds would not have gone along. Surely he was a bigot, but he was a principled bigot, and his principles demanded neutrality. Quote, that the state may do much, go very far indeed, in order to improve the quality of its citizens physically, mentally, and morally is clear. But the individual has certain fundamental rights which must be respected, close quote. For instance, he objected to the Harrison Narcotics Act not only because he thought it infringed state police power, but also because he thought it violated due process by shifting the burden of proof to the accused. While the government generally prosecuted only junkies and dealers, the Harrison Narcotics Act permitted it to prosecute anyone it liked. And lots of people owned narcotics they purchased before Congress passed the Harrison Narcotics Act. Ultimately, the U.S. v. Miller court's reading of the Second Amendment simply reflected popular sentiment and conventional wisdom. In 1939, the federal government promoted widespread firearms ownership, providing surplus military rifles to the public in order to ensure civilians knew how to use firearms. And most scholars assumed the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to possess and use firearms subject to reasonable regulation. Conclusion, the last section of this law review article. So what did U.S. v. Miller hold? At a minimum, it held the Second Amendment permits Congress to tax firearms used by criminals. At the maximum, dicta suggests the Second Amendment protects an individual right to possess and use a weapon suitable for militia service. And in general, it implies the Second Amendment permits reasonable regulation of firearms. In any event, the court left legislators a lot of wiggle room. But what does U.S. Miller tell us about the meaning of the Second Amendment? Maybe nothing. Some believe precedent cannot bind the Constitution of a sovereign people. Others believe the original meaning of a constitutional provision always trumps precedent. Still others believe in an instrumental constitution to which precedent supplies only the contingent value of stability. Nevertheless, faint-hearted originalists and incrementalists alike might find U.S. v. Miller useful or even appealing. After all, it anticipates the status quo. Federal, state, and local governments may reasonably regulate firearms but may not prohibit them altogether. In other words, maybe Justice McReynolds got it right at least this once. And that's it, folks. That is the Law Review article, The Peculiar Story of United States v. Miller by attorney Brian L. Fry, published in the New York University Journal of Law and Liberty in 2008, weeks or months before, just before D.C. versus, D.C. versus Heller was published, the first of the latest series of modern U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence on the Second Amendment. All right. Well, I hope everybody enjoyed that. I know I did. I am going to follow this up by doing a recording of Justice McReynolds Miller decision. And I'm going to do that as a separate show. And when I have that done, I'll link that in the description, both for part one and part two of this reading of the Law Review article. So with that done, I remind all of you, if you carry a gun, so you're hard to kill, carry a knife, carry pepper spray, study jujitsu, so you're hard to kill, then you also owe it to yourself and your family to make sure you know the law, so you're hard to convict as well. Until next time, perhaps the reading of U.S. v. Miller, I remain attorney Andrew Branca for Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.